serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and some of the history brought to life this week thanks to the discovery of the USS Lexington, 2 miles below the spot in the Coral Sea where it was sunk in May of 1942. Before we're done, I'm going to ask 95-year-old Gordon Scott about what he would look for if he could go back and explore his old ship. But one important distinction about the crew of the Lexington, unlike the cruiser Indianapolis, for instance, the last World War II ship that Paul Allen's RV Petrol team discovered last year, the men on the Lexington had the rest of the war to endure. The Indianapolis tragedy unfolded right before the end of World War II, while the Battle of the Coral Sea, in which the Lexington was sunk, was one of the first major naval engagements of the war. Gordon Scott had gone in before the war started. He remained in uniform until after it all ended. And 6 months after the Lexington sank, he was participating in the invasion of North Africa aboard the escort carrier USS Sewanee.
I have never seen so many ships in my life. There was transports with crews. There was some destroyers that had been old destroyers, what we call four stackers, that had been converted and loaded with Marines to take them in close and land them. And ships of every caliber, I mean from battleships to carriers to cruisers to destroyers and transports loaded with men, and I just couldn't believe it. I mean, there was a number of ships. The only trouble we had in North Africa wasn't from aircraft or anything, but submarines. The Germans had a lot of submarines, and there was a lot of fishing boats that were still out in the water, and they even threatened some of them to blow them out or get out of there, because they were radioing, I think, some of these submarines, and they sank several submarines when they were there, but none of the ships were hit, but were never attacked by any aircraft or anything. But an invasion there was a French port. In the Vichy French there, they had Jean Bart, I think was a battleship that the French had, was in there, and we sent planes in and were bombing those, but they couldn't bomb any of the ships in there. They didn't want to touch any of the French ships. So it was quite a diplomatic deal. I mean, a diplomatic war. But anyway, that was probably the first invasion they started from Casablanca into Italy. And
so what happened to you the rest of the war? Because we're only about halfway through your 6 years in the Navy.
Left there, came back to Norfolk, Virginia. And after refueling and reprovisioning and getting planes and stuff back aboard, we took off and we didn't know again where we were going. And we finally got out and we went through the Panama Canal. And we went through the Panama Canal at Christmas. Got through the Panama Canal and back out to the Pacific. We headed for the South Pacific and we landed at Niumea, New Caledonia. It was a big bay that we'd anchored in there. And the captain wanted to get some flight time in. I was in the air department there. I don't know how he asked me, but he asked me if I wanted to go up with him in one of the seaplanes that we had. He had a hard time getting it off of the water. He had to bounce it a little because there wasn't too much wind. And he finally got it up and flying out around their New Caledonia there in Niumea. He got up there and he radioed back and says, "It's all yours," laid back like that. And I flew the thing around for a while, and I kept the darn island in sight, because I'd get lost if I'd got out in the ocean. But we came back in and landed and hoisted the plane back. I think it was what we called a seaplane called a J2F that was a combination of a seaplane, and it also had wheels that could let down and land on regular runways, too. We landed and brought that back aboard. We kept that down in the hangar deck, and they used it just for utility purposes and fly back and forth in some of the islands there.
Let me ask you real quick, because I was watching your facial expressions as you told that story, and you shared early on that you got into the Navy because you wanted to fly, and you had that dream of being a pilot. And now, thanks to his invitation there and his letting off the controls, you had that chance to fly that plane during World War II. What kind of excitement was that for you?
Like I said, I kept the island pretty much in sight. It wasn't probably just a straight line flight. I probably had it up and down and in and out a little, but was able to straighten it out after a while, and he slept a while and finally came back when we landed back.
Is it an exaggeration for me to say it was a bit of a dream come true for you?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I never thought of it, but it was quite a deal at that time. I kept trying to get transferred and figured I had a better chance if I could get off of there to get maybe go to flight school or something. Finally, I got a deal that if I could get off of the ship. The ship was going to get underway the next day. They had a list. They were going to transfer some people off. And in the meantime, I had advanced my rank, and I was the chief petty officer at the time. And they told me if I could get off before the ship got underway the next day with the party to go to this transport, I got transferred back off and sent back, got back to San Francisco, got 30 days leave, and got married. Was shipped to Corpus Christi, Texas, and I was stationed at the Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi, Texas, where they trained a lot of planes. But in the meantime, I'd got married and wasn't too interested in going to flight school then. Was in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I got stationed in what they call an O&R or A&R, was assembly and repair. They'd bring a plane in one end of the building and take the engine out and disassemble the engine. They had this engine department disassemble, and then the deal and goes in and rebuild the whole engine. Got a new engine, put it out the front door, and the plane going through and rebuilding the plane. So you're putting new products. It was actually a factory.
So were you in Corpus Christi then when the war ended?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was in Corpus Christi till July of 1946.
What was that like there when that news hit where you were that this is over? You were in at the beginning of it back in December of 41, and now it's finally come to an end, and you're on the right side, the side that won.
Well, it was quite an experience, and exhilaration was just... was glad it was over for the poor people that didn't make it home.
Would you say you were kind of relieved? Did you feel like you could get on with your life now that this was over?
I had an opportunity. Originally, I thought at the one time I would stay in the Navy, and then I had an opportunity to... My father-in-law was in business here, and he offered his son and me. His son was a naval pilot that went in after again with college, and his other brother was a Marine pilot, both of them killed. By the way, anyway, was offered an opportunity to go in business here, and we opened up a auto parts store here in Kingsburg, and I was here 43 years and built it from scratch. My other brother-in-law that went in with me, he went back in the service and was killed during the Korean War.
I'm just listening to this, and you talk about your brothers-in-law who were killed in the war, and of course there were those lost on the Lexington, and you had the opportunity to go there to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight to see the World War II Memorial and to look at that wall of gold stars representing all 405,000 killed in World War II. What was that experience like for you? Did you think about those guys I just mentioned?
Paul, I sure did. I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is. And to go back there, I'd been to Washington, D.C. with my family one time, but never like this. And to see the wall and the names of the deal, and it's just unbelievable. And then to come back with the people in Fresno, with the people from Lemoore Naval Air Station there standing in their dresser whites, saluting there as you came through the deal. It was just, I thought the whole Navy was there. I tell you, it's one of the greatest things that I have ever seen. I had mail call.
And did you know that was coming when you were on the plane back?
No, I didn't. That was, it just was unbelievable. And I was clear in the back of the plane when I got that packet and opened it. And I really didn't read all of them. But then when I got home and got to reading them, there was two kids here from the Herndon Barstow School in the sixth grade that put their name and address down in the class they were in and asked if I would write them and let them know what we'd done and everything. I was so impressed, I went by and seen them. And they brought them into the main office, and I was just thrilled to see these two young children. But it was wonderful.
I want to say thank you for serving our country and also for telling us about it. I know it's not always easy to talk about it. When you think about your children, your grandchildren, you're a great-grandfather, there are a few generations of your family that wouldn't be here if some of those what-ifs had gone the other way in your story. What do you want us to know and think about when we hear your story and we think about World War II?
I think World War II, the people that were in World War II, came home to people here that appreciated what we'd done and everything, and I think it's a real shame that they didn't do that in the other so-called wars that we had from the Vietnam and the Korean War. It's just totally amazing. But to see the people now, and even back on this trip back to Washington, when we landed in Baltimore, here were people greeting us there. I mean, it just, I don't know how this word has got around, but it's like a new deal, what's happening. Resurrection of thanking the people that were in the service.
Does it make you feel like you did something that mattered?
It certainly does. It's just hard to believe that the people now, and even in Baltimore, my God, they go through there in lines, and people come up to you, see with your jacket or your hat, come up, and the people in Washington, D.C., same deal. I don't know how many were in Fresno when we came home, and we were 2.5 hours late. And to see this, the bagpipes and the people lined up, and going through this line, and all these sailors there standing there, and I got down to the end, I couldn't believe it. Here, my whole family was there, from my grandsons, other people that I knew and everything, and they had waited 2.5, 3 hours, too. I just couldn't believe it.
I don't know if this is an easy one to answer or not, but I've just heard you tell your story, and from, you know, being on the Arizona for a brief while and getting off before it met its fate to leaving that berth near Ford Island that the Utah inherited and sank to surviving the sinking of your own ship and all those close calls. How do you account for that? How do you figure out why you and why you're still here and enjoying life?
Well, I think the good Lord looked after me. I tell you, there was a lot of times that I prayed out there when I was at sea. I don't know why I was picked to survive. And I just can't believe it. I mean, because there have been so many. There was other close calls would happen aboard ship a lot of times. I had one deal that a plane crashed, and I crawled under the turret of this big gun, and about that far, this plane crashed right into this thing. So there's just so many things. A friend of mine, I'm standing one that we were having night carrier landings one time, and I'm standing talking to him, and was off of Honolulu out of Pearl Harbor. Prior to the war, we're training program, or people night flying and night carrier landings, and a plane comes in and busted one of the, what we call the cross-deck pennants that stops the planes, and it whipped around. I'd just been talking to him, and I turned around, and I hadn't got 10 yards away from him, and this plane crashed or busted this barrier cable or cross-deck pennant and hit him and took his leg off. We had a little net off the side of the ship like this, and it was dark, and they just heard somebody moaning and found him here in the net. But he was fortunate. He lost a leg. But, I mean, there's just so many things that crashes. Another time a plane chased me in the flight deck that was coming in for a landing. I was up on the flight deck, and I just bailed out over the side into where the gun turrets were down there. Knocked a guy flat down there, and I just head first. And this plane here, one wing was in the deck, flight deck, and the other one on top one of the guns down there. Just so many things that happened. Like I say, the good Lord had to be looking out for me.
And that hasn't stopped. Just a few more questions for 95-year-old Gordon Scott in light of this unexpected discovery of his ship nearly 76 years after she sank. You're in good shape, and you're of sound mind, Gordon, so how about this hypothetical for you? And I do imagine there are going to be more images and video of the wreckage to be released in the days and weeks ahead.
But if Paul Allen came over here to the Veterans Home of California in Fresno to pay Gordon Scott a visit, he said, Gordon, you're one of the last survivors of the USS Lexington. Would you like to come out to the Coral Sea with us on our ship and watch on our monitors as we send that submersible back down? Would you do it?
Yes, I sure would. I tell you, that's one of the things I'll tell you, that I've always wanted to be able to take a ship that could hit all the islands that we hit throughout this period of time. That would be amazing, too.
Well, and that's something to think about, that as this research vessel, the RV Petrel, is sending its submersible down, it's probably resting on the very same spot of ocean where you guys were sunk.
That's right. It's just unbelievable.
And as it was with last year's finding of the USS Indianapolis wreckage, every precaution will be taken to avoid disturbing the remains of any sailors who could still be down there. And that sensitivity goes all the way back to what happened to that other ship that you were assigned to for a brief period of time, the USS Arizona, where it rests in Pearl Harbor.
They went in and tried to recover some of the bodies, and several of the people were killed with explosions from the cutting torches that we were using underwater, and the families petitioned the Navy to leave the people entombed in the Arizona, which they still are, which I thought was great. There's no point in, I don't know of anybody that's entombed there, because they all had a chance to get off of the ship. They might have lost some, but I don't know of any.
Well, so my other question, and I just wanted to couch it that way, because I understand this may be of a trivial nature. If you were piloting that little remote control undersea vehicle and could search the whole ship, is there some part of the ship that you would want to steer it toward, or something that's still on the ship 2 miles deep that you would want to go look for?
Well, I'd like to see the after part of the ship. I was involved in the arresting gear that stopped the planes when they came in for landings, and we were in the after part of the ship, and my shop was right underneath the flight deck of the carrier. Yes, I would. That'd be great.
You didn't leave anything behind in your locker, did you?
Yes, I left everything in my locker. Several times I thought of going down below deck, going back and getting stuff out of my locker that I had in there, but I never did. I stayed up on top of the flight deck for a long time. Like I say, it started at 11, and that was at 5:18 that night, and I never went down below. I was one of the ones that was lucky that didn't get sent down on a deal and fighting the fires within the internal part of the ship.
So what's still down there in that locker, 2 miles deep under the Coral Sea?
Well, so very definitely some clothing, but I did have a folder and a binder there with pictures and everything that I'd had for years. But I didn't have a lot in it, but probably that was the most important thing to me. Some of the people that I had in pictures and everything they had there. There was one deal right underneath the flight deck that was kind of like a general store. They had all kinds of stuff in there you could buy through normal times aboard ship and everything. And there was a lot of money involved. I did have some money in within my locker, but it wasn't a large amount. But they did have large amounts of money within the ship that could still be there wherever it is. But there'd be no point in trying to get it.
No, and this program reminds us every time that there are things more valuable than money. There are things money can't buy, like the liberties we enjoy in this country, paid for in full by the selfless sacrifice of our men and women in uniform, including 216 who died while serving on the USS Lexington on May 8th, 1942. If you pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a video of Gordon Scott watching the footage sent back from the ocean floor, looking at images of the ship he served on 76 years after he plunged off of her deck into the waters of the Coral Sea. We can all follow Gordon's lead and thank Paul Allen and his team for bringing this important piece of our military history back to the forefront. And we're going to make sure to let Mr. Allen's team know about Gordon and his story. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.